I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, my name's Stuart Miles and welcome to the Apocalypse Podcast. This week, both MediaTek and Qualcomm have been talking up Wi-Fi 7, a new wireless standard that promises to bring a multitude of features that can be used to offer extreme speeds, higher capacity, and low latency to your Wi-Fi network. But with many of us yet to embrace Wi-Fi 6 at home, what does this mean for the likes of you and me? Well, Apocalypse's Luke Baker joins me to tell us more. Meanwhile, it's been 10 years since the very first smart meters rolled out in the UK. With the nation now facing huge energy price hikes and the potential of demand pricing becoming a reality, just how successful has the rollout been and what can we expect in the future? I talked to one of the CEOs of one of the companies that have been involved since the start. Apocalypse's Rick Henderson has been playing with a new pair of headphones from Sony that are designed to let in external noise rather than keep it out. In a world where noise-cancelling headphones have become the norm, does a pair of headphones that focuses on the opposite really work? Well, stay tuned to find out. But first, Luke, tell us more about Wi-Fi 7.
Hey, so Wi-Fi 7 will essentially bring much, much higher speeds, about 2.4 times faster than Wi-Fi 6, which, as you said, most of us still haven't got Wi-Fi 6 yet. As well as using wider bandwidths that can deal with interference better. So in highly Wi-Fi saturated areas, you'll be able to get lower latencies and higher speeds. Wi-Fi 7 promises to bring speeds up to about 40 gigabits per second, rather.
Okay.
Which is the same as Thunderbolt 3 over the air. So
wow. So that's pretty fast, but do we actually have, I suppose obviously this is all theoretical stuff at the moment. We don't necessarily have anything that would take advantage of that.
Yeah. So your ISP won't give you speeds that high, so you won't be able to access the internet at that speed. But things on the local network will be able to take advantage of it. So if you think about when someone moves into a new house and they put gigabit Ethernet cables all over the place and have to embed them in the walls and it costs them loads of money.
Yeah.
Wi-Fi 7 could make that a thing of the past, potentially. Another really interesting use case is for VR and AR headsets and the ability to stream through the Wi-Fi network at Thunderbolt speeds. So you could do wireless transmission of 4K video, well, multiple streams of 4K video per eye for VR headsets.
And I suppose this kind of, when I first tested, like for example, when we first tested sort of the HTC Vive and it wasn't wireless and you had this massive octopus of cables coming out the back, that kind of would negate all of that, wouldn't it? To really, and I know we've got VR headsets like the Quest and things like that now, which are wireless, yeah. But this would kind of give you the original kind of Vive kind of, you know, as you said, 4K, both eyes, all the other stuff, but yeah, completely wireless.
Yeah, exactly. So rather than something like the Quest where all the processing has to be done on board to make it wireless, you can take advantage of a massive, powerful gaming machine and have a much more high fidelity experience, but without being tethered to your table and potentially, you know, knocking into things or tripping over, which was the classic VR experience.
And then I suppose that kind of then takes it to the next thing, which is that if you don't have to have all the processing in the device because it just can connect wirelessly, then the devices themselves can be considerably smaller, lighter.
Yeah, exactly.
And so do you think this is something that will get to a scenario where, you know, that sounds great in the home? Do you see that Wi-Fi 7 has the potential to go beyond that experience and therefore, you know, replace 5G's of this world?
I don't think it will be able to replace 5G, but I do think there's a lot of potential for Wi-Fi Direct. So, you know, when you've got a camera that's got Wi-Fi Direct and you can transfer it to your phone, transfer all your photos and videos to your phone via Wi-Fi. That takes ages and is a real pain. I feel like most people don't use that feature for that reason. But if you could implement Wi-Fi 7 tech in that, then you could transfer gigabytes of data in a couple of seconds. So I think there's potential for that outside the home.
And when do you think we'll be in a world where Wi-Fi 7 is a reality?
So at the moment, it's not even due to be certified until 2024. But MediaTek have already demonstrated it running at full speed. So it is a real thing and it is coming. MediaTek as well said that they think hardware that will be compatible with Wi-Fi 7 will be shipping by the end of this year. So there's potential for, even though it's not a finalized and certified thing, so we might start to see devices that are like Wi-Fi 7 ready by the end of the year.
And we kind of saw that with Wi-Fi 6, didn't we, where devices started showing up before the certification, as you know, you kind of get, you've got to get product out there, because otherwise it's kind of a chicken and egg, isn't it? If you don't have the devices, nobody will go and buy the routers. And if you don't have the routers, nobody will go and buy the devices.
Yeah, precisely.
And how do we have any idea how Wi-Fi 6 is getting on, in that sense of, you know, if you're listening to this and you think, I haven't upgraded my router for a long time, you know, probably it's probably still the same one that came with the broadband provider that I've been with for a long time. Is it worth upgrading to Wi-Fi 6?
I would say so, especially if you are in an area where you have lots of Wi-Fi networks and it can occasionally cause problems with connecting to the network, particularly if you have loads of smart home devices like smart bulbs and everything taking up valuable bandwidth. The Wi-Fi 6 networks can take advantage of a much wider bandwidth, so you can have much more devices, and it can talk to them at much higher speeds than previous generations. So there's still loads of benefit, and I think the adoption is really high with Wi-Fi 6. I think it's about 50% of devices in 2021 that shipped were Wi-Fi 6 enabled. So
it's definitely worth, if you bought new consumer technology, like a new phone or a new laptop or something like that over the last year, which, let's face it, due to the various lockdowns and working from home and hybrid models and all the other stuff we'll probably have, you really should start thinking about upgrading your routers or your network at home to benefit from the speeds that those devices have.
Yeah, definitely. I think a big part of it as well is just giving room for all of the many, many smart devices that we have in our homes to work efficiently without slowing down other devices.
Still to come, Rick gives us his verdict on the Sony Link Buds headphones.
They're designed, and this is what Sony says, to always be worn, whether you're listening to something or not. And for that, they're amazing, because let me tell you, these are the lightest, most comfortable in-ears I've ever had.
10 years ago, smart meters were hailed as the answer to several problems with monitoring our electric and gas usage in the home, removing the need for consumers to take monthly meter readings and catapult the industry into a new era of possibilities. But a fumbling start caused by technical issues has meant that the journey is far from over and way behind schedule. Some have branded smart meters as woeful, botched, and bungled, while others believe that they are the keystone to the UK's green revolution. Pilgrim Biert is CEO of Device Pilot, a company that you might not have heard of, but it's been at the forefront of the smart meter rollout since the start. And with a nation now facing huge energy price hikes and the potential of demand pricing becoming a reality, I wanted to find out how the smart meter rollout was going and whether there's still hope for the technology. I started by asking Pilgrim what the situation with the smart meter rollout was at the moment.
Well, in our survey, we got a lot of answers to that question, some of them very complimentary and some very non-complimentary. But I think my answer would really be there's a lot of potential still to be realized. I think we're still at slightly less than half of all meters being smart, and the rollout's supposed to have been finished by now. So clearly there's a way to go.
And what do you think has caused that, you know, if it's supposed to have been done by now and it's only halfway, what's the sort of challenges that you've kind of faced over the last decade? Do you think that, you know, energy companies have faced that, therefore we haven't succeeded in getting everybody onto a smart meter?
I think anything that rolls out en masse in the real world is going to have a lot of challenges, and you only have to think about the places that people have their existing meters to realize why. They may not be in places that are very accessible in terms of wireless, you know, buried deep inside buildings, or often the meters are actually quite old and wired in quite an old way. So there's a lot of other work that needs to be done at the same time. So I think a lot of it's just that there's a lot of electrician hours needed to get the job done. In addition, it is, or was at least, a relatively new technology, and obviously any new technology comes with its own teething problems. Mm. And it did take quite a long time for that to really get sorted out. We had these initial SMETS 1 smart meters, which weren't possible to move from utility to utility, and that caused, I think, quite a lot of problems. But that's all behind us now.
And that kind of, I think that's probably one of the sort of concerns, isn't it? That it's like, well, if I get this from British Gas, for example, and then I move to EDF or I move to Octopus or whatever, will that still work? You know, and I think, do you think that's been one of the issues that people felt that they were locked into a carrier, so to speak?
Yeah, that definitely was a problem in the early days, but I think that is now well and truly resolved. So if you get a smart meter today, you certainly should not suffer from that problem.
And do you think there's been, in the time that we have had, and the kind of use of these, is there anything that surprised you about the data that we're currently getting out of these devices?
I think whenever you roll out a lot of things, you have to go through this curve where you learn as you go along, and you have to drive the quality up. Because if you have a small number of connected things, then you can actually tolerate quite low performance numbers, because you can go and address the problems one by one by sending out a man in a van or whatever. But as the numbers get bigger and bigger, you have to have higher quality. Otherwise, the sheer number of problems you're dealing with is just overwhelming. And I think it seems to me like there's still a way to go in terms of the level of quality of smart meter experience. And that's partly to do with some technical challenges still, but it's also to do with things like configuration, making sure they're set up correctly for the user.
And do you think obviously 10 years is a long time, and therefore do you think the sort of the needs of the house have changed drastically? You know, we now see EVs and are more of a focus to sustainability and things like that. And do you think therefore that's all those things are helping to play into the hands of the smart meter, that it becomes more relevant?
I absolutely do. I think actually over the last 10 years, there hasn't been that much change within households, but I think there's enormous change coming over the next 10 years. And that's why now it really is the time when smart meters will come into their own. Historically, perhaps one of the things they've been most useful for is simply reading your meter, which has a benefit to the utility and a bit of a benefit to you, but a relatively small benefit. Mm. But I think the kinds of benefits that will come from smart meters in the next 10 years will be much, much bigger, because they'll play a key part in things like EVs and possibly heat pumps and other smart energy devices that will come into many people's lives in the next 10 years.
And I suppose that's one of the concerns many people seem to have, is what do they do? And apart from, as you said, apart from delivering that, you know, here's my meter reading to the gas company or the electric company that this is what's happening, there is a sense of well, it tells me I'm using lots of energy at the moment, but like, what am I supposed to do with that? How do I enact in that? Do you think that's perhaps been one of the failings, or do you think we're starting to get to a position where, rather than you just running around turning on a kettle to see what happens to the smart meter, or, you know, turning a light switch, it will change the way we use electricity and energy in our home?
Yeah, I think with static pricing for electricity, the value of a smart meter is relatively small. But as the price goes dynamic, which it is now for a number of reasons, then smart meters become, you know, they really come into their own. So we're going to see time of use becoming quite common now. So if you have an EV, you almost certainly want to be on a time of use tariff, so you're paying perhaps a third of the price at night time to charge your car. That's still static time of use, so you know that between certain hours it will be a much cheaper tariff. It's a little bit like the Economy 7 that people with storage radiators are so used to for decades. But then it goes beyond that to dynamic time of use pricing, and already we've seen some experimental tariffs from utilities like Octopus, and I think Bulb, where they're actually altering the pricing dynamically to reflect that the cost of electricity on the grid, which itself varies enormously. And once you get that kind of situation, then you really do need a smart meter to track how much you have paid for every half hour over the last month or whatever. So, the kind of intelligence and the time-based nature of a smart meter becomes essential.
Now, you've been around in this industry, I hope you don't mind me saying that, for quite some time. First launching AlertMe, which was kind of all about sensors in the home, and then moving on to, which then became Hive. How do you feel the smart home has changed over the last decade or so? And do you think it's going in the right direction? And do you feel we've sort of load lots of questions at you at once? Do you feel it's kind of, it's still moving with the same excitement and pace, or is it kind of slowed down?
The funny thing is, if you get involved in an early market, then you usually simultaneously feel very excited and very frustrated. Because on the one hand, if you look at the last 10 years in the smart home, although there has obviously been a lot of progress, and in particular, the arrival of the big players like Google and Amazon and Apple into the home, that has definitely had an effect. You know, there's lots of Nest thermostats and so on out there. Those are still quite sort of point solutions, aren't they? They each exist on their own. And although all these players clearly have a game plan around creating a sort of hub in the home and talking to other devices, I would say it's only really the enthusiastic early adopters, you know, the gadget freaks, people like me, that really are making the smart home smart by connecting other things. And for normal people, it's still really complicated. There's not nearly enough interoperability, and that actually makes it very hard to make your home smart. Especially if you think about how our energy devices in the past have worked, you know, thermostats and things like light switches, they're incredibly simple, and most people know how to use them. And going from that to a world where you've got to use your smartphone to understand what's going on and to configure things, and it might not be clear why something's turning off. You know, is it your Google Hub deciding that it's playing a routine or whatever? You know, it can potentially be very, very complicated. So what we discovered at AlertMe was, as we went from the early adopters who will tolerate a lot of complexity in order to get the whizzy features into the mainstream, mainstream customers do not have the time or attention or interest really to spend in all that kind of fiddling about and configuration. They need stuff that just works out of the box and it's incredibly reliable. And I think we are still not there with the smart home. So I think it's two things. It's making it really reliable, but it's also making it joined up. So all these different smart devices can start to interact. And one of the things they'll be interacting with is the smart meter. You know, your washer or your dryer or your heating or other things could be much more intelligent about how they use energy if they could talk to the smart meter and understand about pricing, or go via the internet. I mean, it doesn't have to be local to the smart meter, but you know, joining things up allows them to be intelligent and to make your life more simple.
Now, with the new, it's Matter, isn't it, which is the and Thread, do you think that has the capability to be able to take some of that data and usage and join the dots, or do you think it's still very early days?
Yes, it definitely has that potential, but we thought that 10 or 15 years ago with Zigbee. So it has been a very, very long time coming. And in many ways, what Matter does is not rocket science. I mean, it could have been done a long time ago, but I suppose you need all that kind of pressure from all the different users, the big players like Google and so on, who are just keen to get the sort of ecosystem benefits of being able to attach lots of devices to their networks, and not just attach them, but actually understand what they are once they're attached. So I think that's something that always interests me about these standards for connectivity. Actually just connecting something from A to B as though it's a piece of wire, well, that's not that hard. But it's the higher layers of connectivity so that you actually understand what's connected. You know, if I bring a new thermostat that's built by some no-name company in China and I put it in my smart home, my home hub, maybe my Google or Amazon or Apple home hub, should understand what that thermostat is without having to have any sort of magic knowledge. You know, what is this thing? What can it do? What should I tell it? What does it need to know from me? So those higher levels are the challenge.
And looking forward to the future, sort of, you know, having seen back the last 10 years, I presume 10 years ago, if we had this conversation, we were like, yeah, 10 years, everybody have a smart meter, it's done. Do you think we'll be that, you'll be able to claim that in 10 years time? Or do you think we're in a kind of, now it's feeling like there's a bit of a hockey stick momentum and it's going to catch on a bit faster?
Yeah, I think meter installs have accelerated hugely recently, and there's a real drive now because there are so many reasons to do it now. So I think we will see pretty much all homes having smart meters by the end of the next 10 years, even by the next 5 years. Actually, I think most homes will have them. But it's only one part of a much bigger story, obviously, around sustainability. And I think there'll be lots of other stuff going on in parallel. But I think smart meters will be a key part of the story.
Okay, so let's say you've got a smart meter, the data's working correctly, you're in a future where your EV's charging at the right time, and your washing machine is saying you should probably hold off another 20 minutes to get better electricity. Do you see that happening, or is that too rosy a picture to paint?
I think that's a great goal to aim for. I think the reality, as we all know, is that if each of these devices on its own is somewhat unreliable and difficult to configure right and so on, then the combination of all these devices could be a real dystopia. And that's really one of the reasons that we started Device Pilot. I think it's really important to get the service quality, the amount of time that any device spends actually working, really, really high for the end user, so that stuff just works like the light switches and other devices that we're familiar with. And then the result of all of these things working together will be really good.
Headphones today come in all shapes and sizes, however they all share something in common. They're designed to block the outside world out so you can concentrate on listening and enjoying your music. The Sony LinkBuds, however, take the opposite approach. These headphones from the Japanese electronics giant are designed to let external noises in, so the wearer is constantly aware of their surroundings instead. Pocketlink's Rick Henderson has been wearing them to find out whether the idea is likely to catch on, and is here to tell us how he's been getting on with them. So, Rick, what are they like to listen to?
Well, they are very odd, let's put it that way. You know, it's a very new concept. They're quite unique. They're tiny. They fit in the ear perfectly. They're very comfortable. But you asked what they like to listen to, and that's a double-edged sword. Now, let me start by telling you what the LinkBuds are really for, right? They're not designed to wear when you're commuting on a train, not necessarily, because they come with no specific ear tip. So you don't put them in your ear canal. They just kind of rest on your ears, or sort right. of like in the sort of like the lobes. They have a little sort of like a little plastic thing that connects into the top of your ear, so they do stay in really well. But there's the actual driver, the part that projects sound into your ear, is what they call an open ring driver, which means it looks like a polo mint.
Okay.
And on that polo mint,
it's getting weirder and weirder by the moment. Every time you carry on going.
Yeah, there are lots of little tiny holes, and of course that's where the sound projects from. Right. And it projects into your ear. But because there's a hole in the middle, you also can hear your surroundings perfectly well. Now, most headphones now have active noise cancellation,
yeah,
which is designed to stop any external noises. But these do have adaptive volume control, so that when the external noise is too much, the volume will automatically go up. And that is really cool. However, I found in practice there's a limit to that. I've tested them in both a taxi and on the tube, and in both situations, certain things could not be were not audible.
I mean, I presume on the tube it's a no go. The tube, the London Underground, is a no go anyway. This sounds to me very similar to a lot of ANC headphones offer, which is kind of like a transparency mode. You know, whether it's the Bose Quiet Comforts where the air hostess is talking to you and you tap the side, don't you, and you can hear what they're saying, and the AirPods have a transparency mode so you can, you know, hear people if you need to. Why not just go down that route?
I've always found transparency mode myself a little bit hit and miss. I've worn my headphones on planes before and tried to listen to what the hostess, and ended up just having to take the headphones off or take them out of my ears. And transparency mode is obviously an option on certain things. These, you can genuinely hear what's outside without having to take them off. And the idea behind them is that you never have to take them off. They're not really designed for playing music when you're in a busy circumstance. They're more designed for home working, which is obviously a massive thing at the moment. Mm. Imagine you're on a Zoom call, but the doorbell rings. If you're using ANC headphones or over-ear headphones, you might not actually hear it. With these, you can clearly hear a Zoom call and you can hear the external noise around you. So if you've got kids, you can hear them fighting in the background. But you can actually, you know, they're designed, and this is what Sonny says, to always be worn, whether you're listening to something or not. And for that, they're amazing because, let me tell you, these are the lightest, most comfortable in-ears I've ever had.
And that was going to be my question, is if they're designed to wear all the time, are they comfortable?
That's the thing. You actually, once you've put them in and about 10 minutes later, you forget you've even got them on. They're really, really light. And of course, because they're not obstructing any noise, then you can just go about your daily life as per normal. They're really, really comfy. The other thing about them is that the music playback performance is actually really good. Now, the thing is, Sony makes one of the best pairs of true wireless headphones out there anyway, the WF-1000 XM4s. And a lot of the technology they've used in those, they now use in the Link Buds as well. So it's the same V1 processor. It's the same DSEE upscaling technology for low bitrate music. So the actual playback is really good. It's just that, you know, they are horses for courses. You have to wear them in circumstances. Another good example of where to wear them, if you're out running, obviously you want to hear if there's traffic or people sort of like stalking you behind you or coming up behind you. You want to hear your surroundings. So they're really good for that. And music is definitely the best example, as well as video calling. One problem I did have is sitting in not even the noisy circumstance trying to watch a Netflix show. They weren't great for that.
Right.
And so dialogue didn't punch through that well.
So if you listen to Radio 4 in the UK or you kind of, public service radio somewhere else, then that's not necessarily, these aren't going to be super great for those. But
you'd have to listen to it at quite high volumes, really.
So, okay. So here's the question then. Are they too radical enough that they won't catch on? Or do you think within a couple of years, this is what everybody's going to be wearing?
It won't be what everyone's wearing, but it's a nice alternative. There's another good example, and this is my wife finds it hard to find earbuds that will stay in her ears. She's got really small ears, and she gets slight pain in the ear canals when wearing earbuds. So these would be perfect for someone like that, because they just sit in there and they're very, very comfortable. And if all you care about is music, it really doesn't matter. You know, if you're just even on the tube, you could hear music. Mm. You just couldn't hear sort of like real sharp definition. So it was not great for dialogue. So I can see a niche market for them, certainly. Can I see them be taking over from conventional earbuds? No. Especially with TWS earbuds getting smaller and managing to shrink down with each generation anyway.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, pip pip.